Welcome to On DoD, sponsored by Hewlett-Packard Enterprise on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Now, here's your host, Jared Serbu.
And thanks for listening this week. On this edition of the program, we're going to devote our attention to one of the lesser discussed topics in the Defense Department, software. It is hugely important, not just because the department spends billions of dollars every year to buy and build it, but because it's increasingly a vital part of every piece of equipment the military fields nowadays. Or, as Defense Secretary Ashton Carter put it recently,
you know, all the planes, ships, tanks, there's no point in having any of that stuff in today's world unless you can connect it all. We are very dependent upon networks that are secure. And are our networks secure? No. We spend an enormous amount of effort and an enormous amount of money on that. And by the way, that's one of the areas where we welcome people to come and help us.
But a new report from the Center for a New American Security argues that the department needs a drastically different approach to buying and building software, that it needs to break its habit of buying proprietary systems and move to a world of open source. As the authors point out, that doesn't necessarily mean revealing DoD's cyber capabilities to the rest of the world. If it's done right, it does mean the government can build and improve its systems quicker, cheaper, and more securely. So the argument goes. Ben Fitzgerald is the lead author of the report. He's the director of the Technology and National Security Program at the Center for a New American Security. Ben and I conducted this interview over Skype. That's something Microsoft's terms of service require us to let you know whenever we're broadcasting a Skype conversation on the radio. And yes, I do recognize there's a certain irony there, given our topic today. So, Ben, just to start us off, maybe we should define our terms a little bit, mostly because there's a fair amount of buzz right now around open architectures in DoD. Obviously not the same thing as open source software, but I sometimes hear those terms used interchangeably. So maybe you can deconflict those two concepts a bit and maybe tell us how they work together.
Yeah, one of the challenges as we were writing this paper on open source software is that open is very popular for any number of things. So right now we have the Department of Defense is interested in open systems architectures, whereby you will allow the interfaces between systems to be, the details of those interfaces to be shared so that it's easier for other people to integrate separate systems. That is distinct from open source intelligence, which is intelligence information that you can gather from freely available materials, such as the news or blogs or social media, which is separate again from open data, which is data that is freely shared, which is separate from open source software, which is what we're talking about, which is software for which the source code is exposed so that other people can see how the software has been written. And depending on the license that you use, you may be allowed to take that source code and change it yourself and improve it for others to use.
And you and your co-authors make the case that open source is at least part of the answer to the concerns about dwindling technological superiority that senior DoD officials and Congress have expressed so much concern about lately. Make that connection for us.
So often when the Department of Defense talks about technological superiority, it's really talking about platforms. Do we have better aircraft than our adversaries? Do we have better missiles? And we tend not to think about what makes those things most compelling and most advantageous. So the department in general doesn't spend a lot of time talking about the software advantages it gets from new systems, although that's starting to change with things like the F-35. And then even within that conversation of software, we don't really talk about, well, what's the licensing mechanism? And we've seen in many other industries that you can use open source methods to really move an entire field forward. So if you look at something like artificial intelligence, there are companies like Google and Facebook spending a lot of money on this, but they're also making a lot of that information openly shareable because they want to learn from each other, and they'll compete on certain products, but they'll help move their entire field forward using open source methods.
And on security, you also make the case that going this route can actually be more secure than the proprietary way that we tend to do things now, which I think to some people is sort of counterintuitive. Why can you get better security through open source?
So if you are using closed or proprietary software, in many ways, you are hoping for, the old term is security through obscurity. if no one sees your software or no one sees any of the code or the code that you've used to build that software, that they won't be able to mess with it very easily. But increasingly, that's proving not to be the case. That's how you get zero-day exploits that no one knows it's an issue, even the person who wrote the code, and that allows an adversary to have additional advantage as they plan out, especially cybersecurity operations. What we're seeing, though, is that if you share code and have lots of eyeballs on something, if you have the ability to implement that quickly, changes to those to those flaws quickly, you can stay ahead. Especially when you've got large numbers of people looking at your systems and probing them in different ways, you have lots of vulnerabilities, even if people can't see your source code. So we think that it's advantageous to recognize those risks and take a different approach to addressing them. I would also say that we're not advocating that for every single system in the Department of Defense, but for many systems, it's probably going to be a good approach.
And I think you say toward the end of the paper in your recommendations that essentially open source should be the default position for developing new software or improving software, unless there's a good reason to go proprietary. Why do you go that far, and what would the exceptions be?
So the reason that you would want to start there is that we've seen that open source software has a lower total cost of ownership. We recognize that there are costs associated with using open source software. Just because it's a free license doesn't mean it's free to implement. But that we should start there because there are advantages in terms of cost, but also the ability to collaborate, which is so important for the department and a key inhibitor to innovation and rapid change. Just those two ideas are enough, I think. But there are additional benefits in terms of how you manage your code, how you bring motivated individuals and really leading edge software engineers into the department that necessitate that approach. Now, in some instances, you may not have the capability resident in open source platforms, or it may cost you more money to develop it from scratch than acquiring it from a proprietary system. And there are actually laws that mean that the department can't go out and recreate commercially available software. So we understand that. And in some instances, you're going to have proprietary systems that you just won't want anyone to have access to for alliance reasons or for other reasons, where you build your own code and not share that widely. But by and large, we think that that would be the exception rather than the rule.
Let's stick with legal issues for a minute, if we can. On licensing, my understanding of most of the commonly used open source software licenses is that, yes, you can take whatever you want freely and repurpose it, but any changes that you make or any improvements that you make to the code have to be contributed back to the community from whence the code came, which I could see being a problem or a concern if you're building a sensitive national security system, no?
So it really, there are lots of different license types. And so the Department of Defense has flexibility about how, or any organization has flexibility about how it would seek to do that. You don't necessarily have to share all of your code back with the community. I think that it's more that if you take code from a community and don't provide any useful contributions, you're not necessarily going to have good collaboration in the future. So there are more social reasons to collaborate rather than from a pure licensing perspective. And this is one of the other misunderstandings that often occur in the DoD context, that if you go open source, that you have to share all of your code and that you have to give it all away. There are a variety of different open source software licensing methods out there. And in fact, the Department of Defense in 2009 laid out in an internal memo how DoD project managers should think through those licensing mechanisms.
One of the observations you make is that there is pressure, a bottom-up pressure, to adopt open source within DoD, but it really has never caught on at the top leadership levels. And I think you see some of that. There has been some move toward open source in communities like Forge.mil, which is DoD only. There's even a secure, secret-only version of that site. What are the observations that you have about where open source has caught on in DoD and what's inhibited it from taking root at a larger level?
So we've seen it really catch on in the deeper, more technical areas where it just makes the most sense and allows for the best technical outcomes. So for agencies that have that kind of flexibility, they've gone down that path. And we've seen this most notably with DARPA, who have an entire website where you can go and download their code, and also with some parts of the NSA. We have also seen, I should also add that NASA, which isn't technically part of the Department of Defense, has done a lot of work in the open source space as well. One of the the other area that we've seen use of open source is when it has helped an agency achieve a specific outcome that they couldn't otherwise. So some of the NSA's early use of open source software was because it had wanted to share its software with other parts of the federal government. And that interagency process was so complicated, it was actually easier for them just to open source the software. So we've seen that as well. But really, the use of open source software falls into that same category of so many useful innovations that don't move forward in the DoD, where people at the coalface who are out there doing things, either with technology or on operations, they know what works and they want to implement it and they understand. And often, very senior leaders understand the theory and are comfortable with it as well. Things just get lost somewhere in the middle, and you can never find that person who is actually stopping the adoption of any of these things. Somehow, they never exist. But clearly, that is happening.
Well, go ahead, Ben.
No, I was just going to say we see a number of impediments that we talked through in our paper to the sort of wider adoption of open source software. And one is there's these lingering concerns, which we think are unfounded, about the issues associated with the visibility of code. So for many people, if you say open source software, they will say, well, the enemy will then know what we're doing and can beat us. Not really the case. And we talk about that in our paper. And then there's just different management philosophies. Open source software tends to be more community oriented and collaborative and bottom up, whereas the Department of Defense likes to specify requirements that you must follow and build this very specific product, so it doesn't line up as neatly there. And also, it's a bottom-up approach versus the top-down management approach, which DoD likes. There's also acquisition challenges. So it's not very easy for the department to go out and buy something that doesn't cost anything. And it's also challenging for the department that usually buys systems to instead, in an open-source project where you would be paying for software to be developed, or you'd be trying to get a community together behind a certain area. It's harder for them to do the contracting for that. And the final thing is that we don't have a reinforcing ecosystem for open source software. So for commercial proprietary software, we have trade associations that have funded meetings and conferences, and they can invite senior people from government, and those senior people from government, when they retire, can go and work for those companies, and they can influence how or educate the DoD and how to purchase their software and those kind of things. That doesn't exist for open source software, so the system isn't set up to capitalize on the opportunities associated with that capability.
That's Ben Fitzgerald, the director of the Technology and National Security Program at the Center for a New American Security. We'll come back and talk more about the report he co-authored, urging DoD to move toward open source software, after a short break. This is On DoD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbian. Back on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM, this is On DoD. I'm Jared Serbib. Ben Fitzgerald is our guest for this part of the program. We're talking about a report he co-authored for the Center for a New American Security, arguing that the Defense Department should predispose itself toward open source models of buying and building new software. As we talked about before the break, the government's process for developing requirements and its acquisition system don't necessarily align very well with the community-oriented way open source software is usually built. And yet we do have, as of a few weeks ago, a new government-wide policy on software licensing and open source software from the federal CIO, Tony Scott. What opportunities, if any, do you see that presenting for DoD to move in the direction that you'd like to see them move?
So I think that new policy position from the White House is excellent. And in some ways, that's the impetus for this paper that we wrote, because there is a notable exemption within that policy for national security systems.
Which can be just about anything.
Well, exactly. If you go through and look at the statute that they reference, it's actually talking about systems that have data associated with deployed forces, and also anything to do with intelligence. So really a lot of C4ISR networks and those kind of capabilities and weapons systems. If we look at the Department of Defense's relationship with open source software, I can see a scenario in which they will classify almost everything they do as a national security system, instead of saying, well, look, an example that we found of open source software in the department was the booking system at one of the Army's historical centers and museums was created using open source software. I could see a future in which they're like, well, actually, you know what? That's a national security system too. So the policy offers a great opportunity to the department to really embrace this approach and also figure out ways in which it can share software that it has developed with the rest of the federal government, especially for back-end systems and non-combat or military-related software. The department develops a lot of software, and it has, while it has its own flaws, it has much better funding, and it can attract more talent than some of the smaller agencies. So to the extent that it could flow those pieces of software out to other parts of the federal government, that could result in better quality software and significant cost savings for the U.S. taxpayer. So it'd be unfortunate if the DoD doesn't capitalize on those.
Right. So, you know, instead of building the same software component a billion different times for a billion different projects, you can reuse components, which brings me to, you know, potentially another challenge, you know, certification and accreditation for software. That whole process, as you point out, is really expensive. And I think right now it's generally only applied to finished applications, you know, in a shiny shrink-wrapped box, not these small subcomponents or software modules that can be reused. It seems to me you'd need to change that process if you wanted to certify one little tool that can be used over and over in a bunch of different projects.
Yeah, exactly. And this is actually one of the things that DARPA has been working on through their Xdata and Memex projects, where they weren't building end-to-end systems or integrated systems. They've been building components, and they want to make those components available to other people to integrate and build new systems in a rapid and flexible manner. It would make a lot of sense if you're able to certify a component and then reuse that in various areas. And in some ways, I'm not sure that it requires a wholly new system. It just requires a more nuanced understanding of how we're defining software and the management that we want to put in place on top of that. Because exactly as you were saying, if the department is able to develop really secure sort of login components and then put them into a services-oriented architecture that it has helped develop, those are some of the critical enablers for good security, and it could share those with other parts of the federal government in ways that those agencies wouldn't be able to develop on their own.
Ben Fitzgerald is Director of the Technology and National Security Program at the Center for a New American Security. He'll join us for a few more minutes on his report arguing for the use of open source software in the Defense Department after another break. This is On DoD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serviu. Thanks for listening to federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. This is On DoD. I'm Jared Serbu. Ben Fitzgerald is with us for a few more minutes. He's the director of the Technology and National Security Program at the Center for a New American Security. We're talking about a report he co-authored arguing that DoD needs to take advantage of open source methodologies to build and improve the software that underpins almost everything the military does. And Ben, you hinted at this before, but the paper gets to the point that open source is probably a really good fit it for things that have to be highly customized, that don't have a commercial application, that never are going to be used in the business world. Sometimes that's been used as an argument for why we need proprietary software, because it's so mission specific. Why is open source a good fit in those highly customized cases?
Well, I think that it means that it's easier for you to adapt the software over time. And also it helps if you are seeking to have competition around the organizations who provide you software support. If you've got proprietary systems, it's so you can get a vendor lock-in. This will provide a more open basis for competition. And also there are some significant challenges with this from an exporting perspective, but if you've got the export controls and the ITAR system in place, you can do collaboration across nations much more effectively. And we're increasingly seeing that. Again, if we look at the Joint Strike Fighter, how can we enable collaboration and also sharing of software code between allies? There are advantages for that in terms of developing the system, but also from a security perspective, if you want to send out patches and upgrades much more frequently, it will be easier to be able to do that on an open source basis rather than having to fight through export controls and decide, well, is that an upgrade to an existing system or is it significantly changed enough that it's a new system and then needs to get recertified and accredited and new licenses, sort of like new export licenses issued for the software. So that becomes challenging. Hmm. And again, just to clarify there, just because it's an open source license doesn't mean that you need to expose the code for the whole world to read it every time you share it. So you could have an open source license and not put it on SourceForge or not put it in GitHub. You can just provide that code directly to your ally.
But in some cases, the department, I think you suggest, would want to release its code to the entire world so that it can be improved. And as you said, that's people are somewhat fearful of that because they think that it's going to give potential adversaries an insight into how DoD's software works and then start to use some of the same capabilities. Why should people not be afraid of that in terms of other potentially hostile nations taking DoD's code and using it against it effectively?
Sure. So I think that what we are arguing for is flexibility in how we do that. Because right now we essentially never do it. And so in some instances, we'll want to do it, and in others, we won't. The benefits of sharing that code, again, is just letting a broader community see what we do, perhaps less so for weapon systems and more just for our general network security. It's a philosophy of, you know, a rising tide benefits all boats, rather than just trying to hope that smart people won't figure out what we're doing. The other thing that I think we'll find is that there are really strong incentives for smart software developers in the United States and around the world to participate in that. It's a good technical challenge, and it'd be useful to try to find ways in which we can harness that talent for our benefit rather than just laying out there. One of the more interesting things that we've seen, while not open source, coming from the DoD in recent months, is the Defense Digital Services hack the Pentagon bug bounty program.
Yes,
where we had hackers who would go through a fairly simple vetting process and register themselves, go in, and they were provided access, or they were allowed to hit certain DoD websites. That was a big change for the department and very hard to push through internally, but was a resounding success. Now, if we thought about a scenario in which we could take an old proprietary system, which was no longer maintained by anyone, but the DoD was still using and had been using for 20 years, and these systems exist, if we were to open source that code and make it available to that sort of a community, they would be able to do a much better job of finding security vulnerabilities and patching them. And this is the thing that people often overlook. Seeing the code will allow you to identify vulnerabilities. It won't allow you to manipulate the code that's already running in execution on that system. So you can't insert malware just because you can see source code. And so you can go about security in that way. Again, recognizing that there are some systems for which we wouldn't want to share the secret source or even show the architecture for the concerns that you raised earlier, that would allow our adversaries to figure out how to build certain things that we don't want them to be able to. But again, the United States doesn't necessarily have the sort of generational advantages in software sophistication that we had in the 1960s, for example.
Hmm. One of the points that you make, Ben, is that the defense industry, the folks who are, you know, in the business of producing software for DoD, need to start making investments in the open source world and change their thinking a little bit too. It's not just the department. If I'm, you know, a traditional defense vendor, you know, and I've got a 7 or 8 figure contract building proprietary software for a boutique weapons system, I've got a pretty good thing going. What's my incentive to move toward open source?
The incentives are about your ability to innovate, your ability to build a better product, and your ability to leverage that code base for greater efficiency in the systems you're building and in your next systems. However, for the department to truly, for defense industry to capitalize or to be incentivized to do that, will require a different set of incentives to be laid out from the Department of Defense. The core challenge is that for many defense industry actors, where they actually are able to run sustainable business is in the maintenance and upgrades of the platforms that they build. So if the department were to shift the profit making into the development of the system, these defense industry players can act more as technology innovators rather than system maintainers. Obviously, they always do a bit of both, but right now they are heavily incentivized to sort of maintain access to those platforms and do the maintenance, which gives you a desire to use proprietary systems, to understand all the interfaces yourself, and try to lock in just so you can keep your business in a healthy place. But if we flip that switch, which just comes down to how DoD prices things out and what they're willing to pay at what stages of a project's life cycle, you could really change that. And that would enable greater competition in terms of maintenance and upgrades, but it would also make it provided a more flexible set of technologies within the defense military capability portfolio from which you can recombine those systems. One of the things that we're seeing right now, which is really heartening, is the work of the Strategic Capabilities Office, and they are building some new systems, but also what they're doing is, you know, making changes to cruise missiles to extend the range or to hit targets on land or at sea rather than just one or the other, and that's really a sort of like a recombinative innovation rather than building things from the outset. So if you understand both, if you have both open system architectures and open source software, that provides much more opportunity for smart people to get more out of existing technologies than we currently do. Hmm.
And Ben, let me just begin to wrap up by trying to hit on some of the recommendations in your report that we haven't gotten to yet. And I guess I'll just ask, what's it going to take for open source software to see, you know, meaningful adoption within the Defense Department? I mean, is it just a matter of somebody pulling off one big project successfully and saving a lot of money and showing people that the world didn't end after having gone that route?
That would be really helpful. For me, open source software fits in the same category of all of these other important innovations that we know we need, whether it's a better requirements process or ability to reach out to new industry partners. People, by and large, know what's good and can see the benefits, but there's always something missing that stops us from implementing it. There have been countless memos sent inside the department clarifying why it's okay, why it's not illegal to use open source software. People get it, and yet it doesn't change. So I think we're only going to see change if senior leaders say it's important, if, as you say, they support projects which actually use it and see that there are meaningful benefits and hold up those case studies as models of success, and then really work on removing some of those institutional barriers, creating process that allows us to acquire those systems, and then making sure that the financial, in particular, incentives are in place so that technology partners, whether that's the traditional defense industry or new technology providers, can actually run healthy businesses using that technology. It's going to require all of those kind of things. And so we recognize that that's a tall order, but if we don't at least aspire to that, we're not going to move anywhere. And it's this inertia that is significantly contributing to the erosion of the United States' military technological advantage.
Well, and finally, those institutional barriers that you mentioned, I think, are probably more cultural than policy. But would you have to make any significant, I know you're a technology expert, not an acquisition expert per se, but would you have to make significant changes to the acquisition system, to law, to rules, to pull this off? Could you do a big open source project within DoD today?
You could. There's nothing explicitly in the federal acquisition regulations or anywhere else that prohibits you from doing this. There are just few organizational benefits for doing so. So it's lower risk to purchase something from a known vendor. You can blame that vendor if it goes wrong. You're not risking your career if you go with a known supplier, but you would be taking risk by doing something new. So I agree with you. It is primarily cultural. But this is the case for most of our acquisition challenges, that yes, the FAR has lots of problematic elements, but if you've got someone who really knows the FAR and is willing to lean into it, they can make a lot happen. So I think it's ultimately just going to be a question of at what point do program executives and project managers and contract officers and all of these people understand that the benefits of using these approaches outweigh the benefits of using current approaches. And that's going to require some big case studies that count, and incentives flowing down from senior leaders to actively go after this rather than just to maintain the status quo.
All right, Ben, we will leave it there. Thanks so much for taking so much time with us and talking to us. I appreciate it.
No, thank you. This is important stuff, and I'm glad to see that there are still an open source community out there who wants to see change.
Ben Fitzgerald is director of the Technology and National Security Program at the Center for a New American Security. When we come back, we'll finish up the hour with some insights from the Government Accountability Office, which says the Defense Department needs to get better at figuring out when it's time to divest itself of weapon systems. That's next on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. This is On DoD. I'm Jared Servia. Back on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. This is On DoD. I'm Jared Serbu. Changing topics a bit in our last few minutes of the program this week. As we all know, DoD has a very elaborate process that's meant to ensure it only buys the weapon systems it really needs. But there's no comparable set of guardrails to make sure it doesn't get rid of the things it does need. That's one conclusion auditors at the Government Accountability Office came to recently when Congress asked them to look at the Air Force's decision to divest itself of the A-10 fighter. John Pendleton is Director of Defense Capability and Management Issues at GAO. He told me, among other problems, the Air Force didn't adequately account for all the missions the A-10 performs before it decided to ground it.
That really is the most important question here. There will be a bit of a lag there, assuming the F-35 comes on. But everyone, let's talk a little bit about what the A-10 is and what all it does. I mean, it's iconic, right? It's a flying tank. It has the Gatling gun in the front. It's beloved by the many ground troops that it's supported in combat. And everyone knows it for the close air support that it does. But with precision-guided munitions and unmanned systems, we can drop bombs from bombers now and support ground troops and from UASs, and we got different ways to perform CAS, and that's what everyone is focused on, but the A-10 does more, and the CAS community that supports it does more, like combat search and rescue. When a pilot is down, the A-10 pilots and the aircraft are the ones that typically coordinate the rescue mission, and they provide cover for the rescue helicopters that would come in, and it's not clear how the Air Force will perform this mission even after they get the F-35. And then there's the issue of the fact that the CAS pilots focus on these missions, right? That, I mean, compared to an F-16 pilot or an F-35 pilot, an A-10 pilot does 22 close air support sorties in a year to be qualified, where an F-16 pilot does maybe 12 because they're training lots of other missions. So the idea that the multi-role fighters will fill in all the gaps, I'm just not sure that's right.
Yeah, and I want to talk about specific capabilities a little bit more in a minute, but yeah. But I think more fundamentally, no one knows the full extent of the capability gaps because the Air Force doesn't really have a process for coming up with a baseline for what its overall fighter requirements are. Is that fair?
No, that really is an issue. It was an issue for us here because, you know, GAO likes its criteria. We don't want to just make up things. We want to look and see what the rules are, and requirements very often set the foundation for a program. And we really found that the Air Force doesn't have clearly stated capacity requirements for close air support or the other missions that the A-10 does. It sounds like a simple question, how much do you need? But apparently it's not a simple answer. And the lack of such requirements makes it really difficult to evaluate the impact of any shortfall.
And not just requirements for close air support, but requirements or any kind of process for evaluating requirements in light of any kind of divestment decision.
Well, how are you
going
to mitigate the impact?
Right.
The main question, right? I mean, there's more than one way to skin a cat. And what we were hoping to see is detailed analysis about how you would do CSAR Sandy or Forward Air Control Airborne, which is another mission that the department does, or the fast attack, against swarm boats. And we just didn't see the detailed analysis that we were hoping for, even on the classified side.
And it seems like one of the issues that you guys were getting at is some of those secondary missions have been maybe even being neglected in the training environment because there's been such a focus on the close air support capabilities of the A-10.
I think that that is possibly true, but we were more concerned that it wasn't clear to us how we would do some of those things even after we got the F-35 in. The Air Force has stood up some integration groups and things to study that, which I think is sort of a tacit acceptance that some work needs to be done, which is a step in the right direction. But it just wasn't clear to us how they were going to meet these other missions.
How much does the decision to push the A-10 retirement proposal a little further into the out years mitigate some of these capability gaps to the extent that we understand the capability gaps?
Oh, I think it, again, we couldn't do that analysis because you don't have the requirements to give you a precise answer,
mm-hmm.
But the A-10 is the best at many of these things. I mean, it just absolutely is. And A-10 pilots are the ones that really focus on this, the doctors of CAS, they've been called. And by CAS, they mean the things like combat search and rescue, Sandy. It's a catch-all term that means all the things that these A-10 pilots and squadrons do.
Getting back to one of the issues that you mentioned before, just the topic of the Air Force simply not having a good methodology for thinking about requirements that are going to go unfilled if it decides to divest something. How big a problem is that? To what extent is that a DOD-wide problem, I guess, is my question.
I think that really is the heart of the issue. If you step back from just the A-10, I mean, the department has a lot of aging things, and there's going to be more and more decision points where they have to decide at what point to let go of the old stuff to make room for the newer, more capable stuff. And especially if you're still using the old stuff a lot. You know, like I said, we like our criteria at GAO, and we had a problem from the get-go here on this because there's no specific rules for divesting multi-million dollar platforms. I mean, everyone's aware that it takes several acts of Congress to buy something, to acquire something. And lots of laws and regulations, but the services, by contrast, can decide to divest something as part of a budget drill, which is what happened here. The Air Force didn't really want to let go of the A-10; they just didn't have enough money. They couldn't make it fit in the POM.
Sure.
And we saw something similar a couple of years back on with the Navy when the Navy proposed to retire early some cruisers and dock landing ships. And that was another case where Congress stopped them because they just didn't feel like they'd adequately made their case. So we stepped back and we made a broader recommendation here that basically said, DOD, we think you ought to put some guidance out about, you know, the kinds of things you want to consider in these divestment proposals, because it made it difficult for us to evaluate, and it leaves the services a little bit vulnerable when people ask questions. I mean, if you it's an oversimplification, but you know, we have acquisition rules so we don't buy things we don't need. Our argument is we need clear divestment rules so we don't get rid of stuff that we do need. And again, I'm not trying to describe a Byzantine process on the other side that equals the acquisition process, but not having any guidance, I'm not sure is acceptable either.
You mentioned that you noticed this with the Navy program a couple years ago, but as far as the absence of that process around divestment, is that something that GAO's been concerned about in a broader context before, or did this A-10 study really bring that to light?
Well, in my portfolio, you know, I look at force structure and readiness issues, not so much the acquisition side. And so when we got to this point, we started conferring with our folks that do acquisition and started looking at sort of where the department was with a lot of its systems. And again, this capacity, the notion that we need a lot of stuff now and that a lot of it is aging versus, you know, capability, buying new stuff, we started this is going to keep coming up. And so we thought it made sense for us to sort of put this mark in the ground and say, DOD, maybe you ought to think about setting some rules for this to keep from these things from getting sort of pushed back at you from the Congress. The department did not agree. They do not want to do that. They not concur with that recommendation.
Right. As you said earlier, this was a budget-driven decision. But as far as estimating the amount of money that you'd actually save by getting rid of the A-10, you also found the estimates the Air Force had been giving Congress weren't credible, or at least didn't meet best practices for being credible, if there's a meaningful difference between those things. Tell us why.
Yeah, I mean, I could go down that rabbit hole pretty far, but I'll save you from that. We have various aspects we look at in cost estimates, but what they did was pretty simple. They had a bunch of Air Force leaders together, and they looked at various missions, and they said, okay, we've been told to prioritize modernization, and let's look at the cost of all these various missions. And the A-10, you know, in a situation where you're prioritizing modernization, it's nearly 40 years old, many of them, it didn't fare real well. And so they said, well, how much can we save? And what the Air Force did was go into its program, the Future Years Defense Program, and say, how much is in there for the A-10? And that's fine for a broad brush sense of savings, but it left things out. You know, there are things you might have to do if you don't have the A-10 that weren't part of that cost estimate. And it could have overstated or understated how much you would save. So it doesn't give you the kind of fidelity that you need for, you know, to really identify how much you'd save. It's probably in the ballpark, but there'd be costs that probably were not contemplated, and there may be additional savings that weren't contemplated.
And obviously you can't take all of that money out of the FYDP, because one of the things that they've been arguing for is to take their existing A-10 maintainers and move them to the F-35. So that alone is probably a fairly big expense.
Absolutely. I mean, it's, you know, the Air Force has got an in-strength challenge as well. And they're short maintainers already. They'd already started making some of these changes. So sometimes the savings, as you know, in the government is actually a transfer. But the Air Force is quite short on maintainers. Absolutely.
Back to your recommendations. You mentioned earlier that one of the key ones had been kicked to the curb. Any you feel like you've made any headway in convincing either the Air Force or larger DOD about what needs to be done here?
You know, I think despite the Air Force not concurred with our contention that they needed more information should they bring back this proposal to divest the A-10 to really walk through some of the issues that I've described here. The Air Force responded that they felt they had done that and that their analysis, and I'm quoting here because I think it's important for the listeners to hear this. The Air Force said the A-10 divestment was the most acceptable strategy to remain within Air Force budget authority while controlling risk across all mission sets. And by all, they mean Air Force mission sets primarily. And that may very well be true for the Air Force, but that we're not sure that it was necessarily true for across the department. Now, having their non-concurrence notwithstanding, they're doing some things that we mention in the report. Again, they have an integration group. They're talking about how they would meet some of the gaps that are being identified, but we just didn't have enough to go on yet about whether or not those would actually follow through. So despite their non-concurrence, they're actually doing some things that are steps in the right direction.
That's John Pendleton, the Director of Defense Capability and Management Issues at GAO. We'll post a link to the report we've been talking about at federalnewsradio.com/ondod. Earlier in the hour, we heard from Ben Fitzgerald from the Center for a New American Security, talking with us about their recent recommendations dealing with open source software in DOD. If you missed that conversation, we'll post our full program at federalnewsradio.com. You can listen back anytime. That's it for this week's edition of On DOD. Thanks as always for joining us. I'm Jared Serbu. So long.
You've been listening to On DOD with Federal News Radio DOD reporter Jared Serbu. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. On DOD, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.